I'm not going to ask you for any raising of hands or anything else. I'm just going to ask you a question that you answer yourself. Did you feel His presence? When we leave here, then we're going back out into the world, and we're going to the problems of life and living. We're going to run into all these kind of things from day to day. The clash of personalities is where the event's coming from. And I'm going to make this sale. This business is going to turn off. And when we get into all this frustration and the decisions and the things of life, if you can remember back to that morning and sitting there on a Sunday morning, realizing that presence is here. And He, that same presence, will be with each one of us wherever we are. That's where this presence comes from. I guess I could tell you appropriate thing that so much of my life and maybe so much of your life has lived without the presence of God. In my particular case, I had no religious background. I had gone to work as a young boy. I had gotten into booze real early. And I had all the wrong values in life. Nothing but the material world. I knew nothing about, really. The only thing that I, as a child, that I'd heard about God was that the drunkenness was an unforgivable sin. That this was the one thing that this God that I heard about that I thought was a punishing God, that He never forgave people for becoming drunkards. And they said that there was some place that they could quote in the Bible that the drunkard could never enter the kingdom of God. And I said so many times that when I heard that, I thought they meant after you died. I didn't know you could do it while you're still alive. But I went to hell. And I can, and I know that all of you can remember the suffering, the fear, the insecurity in my life without the presence of God. The times and the trouble that I got in, and the progressiveness of this illness, and going down the ladder to these things that I thought were so important, the material things that I was having less and less and less of it. You know my story, so that I know what it is to be without just the necessities of life, much less any of the luxuries. Because in the progressive disease of alcoholism during the years that I was practicing, the society turned a deaf ear to anything. You never heard anything about the illness or the disease. There was always the lack of willpower, the fireness, the irresponsibility, the things that really made the alcoholic a very unlovable person. You didn't have to be down where I was to be unlovable. You could be up there where Ed and Steve and some of the people that were still in the professions and in business and in places that by their own actions and their own thoughts that they were unlovable, unwanted. Even the people who had loved them at one time, the married, the children. The love was gone, so the alcoholic became the unlovable and the unwanted. In my particular case, I went down the ladder enough that I realized this. I knew that I was unwanted. People didn't want me around. I was out of my the kind of people that I was associating with, and the people that I sought out, God or any higher power was not in our vocabulary. If it was, it was the best kept secret that I know of. We never talked about anything like that. I very vividly remember times coming up in drunk for having been fired, the awful fear of wondering what in the world was going to happen next. I lived with that. I lived with the pity of not being able to be like other people, not to have the things, the decent clothes, or a decent place to live, or a decent job. As other people, I lived with resentment towards those things. I lived with dishonesty of trying to cover this up and to do something that I was not. I've had to sober up so many times when I couldn't get a drink, and the hallucinations of seeing the things that went bad. Terrifying fear, and as this increases in a human being's life, hope diminishes. Hope and self-respect is gone. Bill Wilson says in that little book, AA Comes of Age, all the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous can be put into two words: responsibility and humility. And without God, we have no. It's impossible to have be responsible and have humility without God. As times got worse, I never thought that there would ever be anything different. I never, in my wildest dreams, did I ever think that there could be anything like this. That there could be survivors. I am one person that, to my being honest, and I never one time tried to quit. So I didn't think that I could. I knew that I couldn't. And the drink is the only time, a short period of time, that all these boogeymen would go away. The fear, the remorse, and the self-condemnation of what yesterday had been. A drink would make those go away temporarily. Didn't take me long to find out that it was only temporarily because the drink went away in there. Being an alcoholic and not knowing it, I wanted another drink. I had a physical craving for another drink, and I never knew until I got here that the disease of alcoholism is the physical allergy of the body, that if we take one drink, we want more. I never knew that the other part of the disease is the insane, insidious compulsion that people like you and I have to take a drink that we have no control over. And that to remove this insane, insidious compulsion to drink, that there is no earthly power that can remove this. Never in the history of man has he ever found a way for a human power to remove this compulsion that we have to drink. And in many of our cases, maybe all, I don't know, it became an obsession to drink. It did in my case. And as we know, as we sit here this morning, that is destruction. There's no other way. That's the law. That's one of God's laws. This is destruction. We find out after we get here that it's There's only three things that can happen to people like you and I. We either die, we become a wet brain and put in an institution, or we're touched along the way and allowed to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and find sobriety and peace of mind and serenity. The things that we searched for so many years in the bottle, and it was never there. It was never there. I suppose that I had given up myself to die like this, and I never wanted to die drunk. I never wanted to die in the condition that I was in. I guess I tried to the best of my ability, to hide from. I didn't know what I was hiding from, but whatever. You know, drunks in these bars, you never see them inside with all the bright lights, and it's always dark. They seem to be wanting to kind of be in darkness. And the only thing that I'd ever hearing of in those days is that this is killing. I knew that. Well, I told this in front of Noel, and I am not telling it behind his back, but one of my very favorite stories was, because I heard so much of it in my life, that I used to tell my mother, if I was walking down Tryon Street and the corner fell off of the Liberty Life building down there and killed me, they'd say, yeah, liquor finally got him. Seems that this old drunk lived in this parish, and he had been told the same thing over and over and over, and so he got on the bus one morning and he was nearly hung over and had a breath about that long, and about the second stop the bus made, the priest got on, and he was sitting there, and he didn't want to hear what he knew what was coming. So he had the newspaper, and he got it up, and the whole that kind of shooting him off from his breath from the priest. And he knew he had to speak to him. He didn't have nothing to say, but he knew he had to say something to the priest. And so he said to him, he said, Father, what causes arthritis? And the priest knew he had a good opening to really let this old drunk have it. And he said, I'll tell you what causes arthritis. Drinking liquor. Run around wild women, laying out all night, playing poker. Not getting no rest. That's what causes arthritis. How long you had it? He said, I ain't got it. I read in the paper here, the Pope's got it. But I expired for the last time in September 25th, 1949 at the Burns Hotel in Charlotte. For being unable to be sober on the job, I wanted my job. I had a good job. I'd had a lot of bad ones. I had a good job, and I had a wife and a little boy. And I was doing everything that I knew how to still drink and not get into trouble, but I didn't. I was still without any God or any power. And the inevitable came because it had come time and time and time again. The simple reason, those old ideas that just six of them that we read every meeting, the old ideas that was in a continuous thing of doing the same things over and over, the old ideas. And then on a Sunday morning, a beautiful Sunday morning, just like this, I was drunk on the job and I was fired. And I really thought this was the end of the world, and I thought that I would see my family go. I knew what it was to wake up on Myrtle Beach, and down there lying in the sand with no home and none of the necessities really of life. I had a razor stashed up there around an outside shower where I could go up and shave from time to time. All the clothes I had them on my body. I finally got out and I didn't have a pair of shoes. I could think back to that. And I had this beautiful wife and this little boy, and I loved him very much. And I'd never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, but this man, this is no coincidence or no happenstance or circumstance. This was all, in my opinion, and this is what I believe, this was all in the plan of the God that I have a relationship with today. This man, he had fired me, told me that there was a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he knew of a recovery up in Portland, Maine, and we were about 1,000 miles from Portland. But he told me about a man that had lost it all and had gone to the gutter. He lost his family and his business, and he lost everything. And he had gotten into a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had come restored. He had all of these things back, and he said, "Bill, you know, he's one of the most respected citizens in Portland, Maine." And I thought, oh, I'd love to be back there. But I couldn't tell Mr. Creedy the background of my life because I kept it all bottled up inside. I didn't want anybody to know how I had lived or how degrading a life, how immoral that I had been. I didn't want anybody to know that. So I had to put up that old front. But as I sat there and listened, I remember it was just as it was yesterday. That was hope. A little hope that, oh, I wish I could be like that. And then after he fired me, and my wife was still working there, and he asked her on two or three occasions if I called AA. And she said, I remember her telling me that she said, "Mr. Freedy, you just don't know how stubborn Bill is." And it seemed that stubbornness is unwillingness is one of all of our character defects. But I had absolutely nothing to do with this. I had that last drink on a Thursday night, and on Friday morning there was an article in Collier's magazine about a story of a man who had been a drunk. As sick as I was that morning on it, and my eyes burning, normally I would not have picked up anything to read. I'm an avid sports fan. I remember I hadn't even looked at the newspaper that morning for the sports page, but there again, I picked up Collier's magazine and this story was in there. And the one paragraph that I remember, and this was a Jewish boy who, he was the first Jewish man that got sober in AA in New Orleans, Louisiana. He'd gone all the way to the bottom, just like I had. But there was a paragraph in there, and it said, "Everything that I have, everything that I am today, everything that I shall ever hope to have, I shall give Alcoholics Anonymous. And God, as I understand him, the credit." And that was the first time I'd ever seen the word Alcoholics Anonymous in print. On a Monday, I called. And a man came, and there's a man sitting in this room today that knows him, and he's still alive of him. His name is Dave Cox. And he was sponsored by little Davy Ray's grandfather. And Dave came to see me, and he told me, he brought me the message that Bill Wilson and Dr. Barber shared together there in Akron, Ohio in 1935. That we are powerless, and that we must have help. Dave said the way he did it was one day at a time. Bill, I asked God this morning, as I'm standing, for help just for today. And tonight when I take off my watch and put it by my bed, I'll thank the same God for having been sober today. And the first real miracle came into my life that night, and I was unaware of it. And it's the miracle of willingness. And I believe it's the miracle that every alcoholic must walk through that door. Someday, somewhere, sometime, to be willing. It talks about it many times in the big book, in 12 and 12. To be willing. And that happened to me that night, and I was unaware of it, that I was willing to do what they said. That he had been doing. And I started the next morning. And I, of course, I didn't know God. I really didn't know about it. I thanked him the same that night. And I remember that after the 22nd day that I was sober, I knew there was something different. But I didn't have sense enough to really know what it was. But there was something different in my life. We had a club there in Charlotte, Fixed and Fine. It was up on the third floor. Seemed like AA made a sale today. You either got to go up or go down to get there. The guy went up there, and the first meeting on Tuesday night, as we said here, Friday night, it was on Tuesday night, and it was the 4th of October, 1949, the man said to me, nobody here, Bill, can look down their nose at you. And I thought I had been so unworthy, and ever people were better than me, and I never forgot that. But Bill was an iron worker, and he never made this post. Never made it. He did get about 90 days, and in his last year, he died of cancer of the throat. But he had a message for me. That man that I've never known who he was up in Portland, Maine. And I've always thought of him as a copy, a walking copy of the big book. The man who told me about Alcoholics Anonymous was saying. We go up to the club, and I was unemployable, but my wife would give me bus fare, and I could go down to the club and I could sit and listen to these people who were talking about things that I had never heard about before. This was just my experience. I never thought anything about the 12 steps. Really, right at that time, our traditions had not been adopted as part of the program. They were adopted in 1950 at the International Convention in Cleveland. They were there, but I never doubted anything. I was still such a phony. I was to try to move around in that old club, and we had some seats. They were back to back. I couldn't have any input to the conversation, but I wanted to hear what they were saying, and I'd get on the seat behind them. Well, they were sitting the other way, and I could lean back and hear what they were talking about. And strange thing, yeah, I've heard one lie, not from all people, but from quite a few people. And maybe Creighton Pendall was there, and his father came in the fall in February, when I went in October. But there were a few people that were around at that time that they were saying, this is for your drinking only. Alcoholics Anonymous is not for any of your other problems. If you have something, if you have financial problems, go to the bank. If you've got marital problems, go to the counselor. If you've got legal problems, go to the lawyer. Whatever, this is just for your drinking. And I sat over there and I didn't say anything, but I could not believe that. I believed that God, the power that could relieve this terrible thing, these hangovers and all of these things that went with the booze, if he could relieve that, he was powerful enough to do any and all things. I am so glad that I believed that, and there were a group of us who did believe that. And many times in a joking way, they called us bleeding deacons. I really, just through that inherent thing that God, the direction that God gives all of us, I happen to choose these people. We didn't have the thing about the 90 meetings and the 90 days at that time. All the people who went before me, they said, remember the Serenity Prayer. And you get out there, and these situations that come up, you remember the serenity prayer. That's all you have when you're out there alone in this world. I'm glad that they told me that, because I became interested in the serenity prayer. I thought it was the most beautiful language that I'd ever heard in my life. Understood not one word of it. It had never been in my life. Had never seen it before. And I tell you, as I stand here this morning, that I don't believe that I've ever seen four lines in the English language that has the power that is in the serenity prayer. You bring to us the peace of mind, to be able to live and to love, and to regain our self-respect and the respect of our loved ones. It's all in there. I have made one or two talks. I made one talk here of my experience with the serenity prayer, and I'm not going to get into that this morning. I had the problems, the problems that are out there in the world today. And I said the serenity prayer many, 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 many times. And this is part of the practice of the presence of God. Know that God is here. And then I met a fellow, and he and I both were going through a lot of things at this time. He'd been through a divorce and lost his children, and he had his job. He had a very good job, but there was no security there, and he had some boys that was giving him trouble. There was just a lot of things, and he'd travel, and I'd get, and he'd come to my house on the weekend, and we'd talk. He would talk, we'd talk about the presence of God. We'd say, there's only one God, and I sat here this morning and looking out at the beauty out here that's been created on this earth. The beautiful pine trees, the beautiful surroundings and the setting here in this wonderful place in North Georgia. The same God created all of this. The same as He did you and I. He takes care of all of that. Every day. In my part of the country and in the North Georgia Mountains, the changing of the color in the fall, of this gorgeous color that man could never, never, never put together. That He has them that far, the beauty there for us to see and to realize the presence of God. There it says to practice. It says to practice these principles in all our prayers. And Jack and I would sit there. I remember on one weekend, and he said, Bill, this week while we're gone working, every minute that we can become aware of it, wherever we are, whatever we're doing, we're driving down the road or whatever, let's use every minute that we can possibly use to practice in the presence of God. Know that He is there. And then he and I did some looking up in the other big book. I was in, to go back a little bit, I was in Macon, Georgia, back in the middle 40s, and I had gotten fired there, and I'd been up in this hotel drunk for several days, and I had run out of liquor, and I was sick, and I was scared to death, and I was getting under the bed for fear that I would be walking in my sleep or something and fall out the damn window. I knew that if I did drop off to sleep, I'd bump my head on the bed getting up. And this is the kind of condition that I was in. I was about to go crazy. And there was a Gideon Bible over there on the table that all of you are familiar with it in hotels. And I didn't know anything about the Bible. And I picked it up, and I looked in there, and I didn't know where to find anything. but I knew this was supposed to have been about God, the Bible, and there was a little thing in the flyleaf that told you where to look for the different passages in different conditions you might find yourself in, and there was one thing in the little feeling of relief there in that hotel room that night. I never pursued that. I never thought about looking to that again until after I got to AA. And then I heard about another chapter in the Bible. And I, by this time, of course, I know that the people that went before me, before all of us back there, when they were searching and digging, and Dr. Bob, this part of what we're here today practicing, that they found in that old book. And of course, his favorite was the chapter of James, the book of James. But there was another, and I really don't know how we came across it. Jack and I, we came across another psalm. It was the 91st psalm. And in there it tells you that God is our protection. That under his care, he protects us from all of these boogeymen out there in the world, all these insecurities and things. And I had an occasion to have a visit with Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. He was in Roanoke, and he had told a man who worked for him that he would like to meet me. Isn't that something? I couldn't believe it, but he was the one that made the moves and made the arrangements, and I met him. I met him in a railroad station. And one of the questions that I wanted to ask him was about the 91st Psalm. And he said, oh, yes, Bill. They're one of the greatest pieces that's ever been written for mankind. He said, you know, when my mother died, under her pillow, when we found her, that's where the Bible was turned to, the 91st Psalm. This meant a lot to me because I had gained some faith that I knew that I was not here by chance, circumstance, or because I was luckier than somebody else. Because this morning, as we sit here in this beautiful surrounding, and all of us had some laughs and feeling good and been able to eat and whatnot, the world out there is full of suffering people, just like we were. In a jail. In fact, I got a little daughter in jail in Roanoke, Virginia this morning. She's serving her 2 days for her second DWI. Sure, I've been thinking about it. I've been thinking about placing her little daughter with anorexia. I can go and watch her. And the illness and the suffering that's going on out in the world. And yet you and I are here this morning. Sitting in the presence of God with love and understanding in our hearts, and it hasn't always been that way. There's not very much that I could say about this. There's always been things to me in a way. I didn't know really what it was for so many years. I just knew that when I went to AA meetings, I always felt that. And then one day it occurred to me that the God that I believe in, is all powerful, he's everywhere, and at all times. But I never feel as close to him as I do when I'm with people like you. Okay?